Don Quinn that he was not going to be able to make it, even though he had planned up the Friday to be here. Don Quinn has volunteered to fill in Don's place as chair today, so I think we are going to have a few more folks stroll in.
Traffic is terrible.
Traffic is really killing people.
John, okay?
What's that?
John's okay.
As far as, yeah, he just told us he couldn't be here, so I don't know the details. So why don't we keep going? John, do you want to start off and do introductions around the table?
Sure, Ted. John Coon, VA engineer and representing the American Institute of Chemical Engineers, and sitting in John's chair today.
The University of Maryland, Rita Mack, representing the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments.
Jonathan Kayes, University of Maryland, representing Agriculture and Natural Resources.
Larry Schoen, Schoen Engineering, American Society of Mechanical Engineers.
Ross Solovich, University of Maryland.
Ted Abern, I'm Air Director with Maryland Department of the Environment. Why don't we start off back around the back or work around?
Joe Yost, Consumer Specialty Products Association.
And I'm Heidi McCall, I'm with the American Coatings Association.
Patty Farrell, Rambo Environment.
Hussein Vahid, Regulation Development.
Megan Ulrich, Regulation Development.
Justin Mabry, Public Works.
Tom Weisinger, Raven Howe.
Randy Mosier, Maryland Department of the Environment.
Carolyn Jones, Maryland Department of the Environment.
Kathleen Wainis, Reg Development.
Anyone else that didn't get a chance to introduce themselves that's in the room? So do we have anybody on the phone? I know we have the phone line open, so anybody joining us on the phone? No one on the phone as of right now. I'll check in on that later. So Randy, we have three potential action items for today, and you were telling me that the first action item actually requires a majority.
It requires a majority, so what may make sense is if we defer that one till later and see if we get more council members.
We've been talking to you all about some cleanups of the bylaws that we've been working with the chair. They're relatively straightforward, but we do need a majority, so I think if it's all right with you all, we'll shuffle the agenda to put that as the last action item instead of the first, in case we have additional council members show up. So real quick update for me, it's been an interesting summer. I think one of the more interesting things has been that unlike the last couple summers where it's been very cool and unusual, it's been a hot summer. So it's also the first summer where we're required to comply with the new 70 parts per billion ozone standard. The standard used to be 75 parts per billion. So it's an interesting story. If you're just counting the number of days where you went over the standard, with a lower standard, we probably had more days this year where we went over the standard because the standard's lower. But the good news is we haven't seen the levels get real high. And so unlike years in the past where the weather was real bad, we used to have some days where it got real high and we'd have multiple monitors go over. What we've been seeing is we've been seeing levels just get above the 70 ppb standard, occasionally a bit of higher one, and we often get one or two or three monitors going over and that. So it's another clear indication that even in a hot summer, we're making progress. Does it mean we still have more work to do? Absolutely, and that's why we're continuing to bring you all regulations to move forward with. The two that I just want to make sure everybody's focused on, and you've seen this in our written material, is that there's two major NOx control efforts that kick in 2017. The first one is the, I think we briefed you on this past, but the federal Tier 3 sulfur fuel and vehicle standards kick in 2017. And that's a really important rule for ozone because the low sulfur fuel actually allows the catalysts to work much better and achieve very significant NOx reductions. And since it's a fuel standard, it not only affects the emissions from brand new sources, it affects the emissions from the entire fleet. So it's a relatively large NOx emission reduction that kicks in 2017. EPA just finalized something called the Cross-State Air Pollution Rule Update, CASPER Update. It's another round of power plant controls across, was it, Kathy, 25 states? How many states total?
22.
Like 25 states across the East. Power plant controls, probably, EPA will probably be sued, so it'll probably take a little while to get it through the system, but it's a major step in reducing regional NOx. And the two things that we know have brought down ozone in Maryland are regional mobile source NOx controls and regional power plant NOx controls. So that's sort of where we are, and we will keep you all up to date on how ozone continues to progress. The other one that's new is several months ago, EPA finalized its designation for sulfur dioxide.
Before you leave ozone, can I?
Sure.
When you say we know, it's because of the NOx.
Yes.
Is that because we've measured decreases in precursors? No?
Yes, we measure the reductions in the NOx emissions, and we can correlate the NOx emission reductions with the drops in ozone.
Okay.
Like 2000, the best example is that the very first round of deep power plant controls for NOx took place in 2003 and 2004. And it's right after that, 2005, 2006, 2007, that we saw dramatic reductions in ozone, not just in Maryland, but pretty much across the East. And we've seen the same thing with the Tier 2 vehicle standards. It's a little harder to see the Tier 2 vehicle standards because they're phased in more slowly. As the fleet turns over, you see the benefits, but you can definitely see that those NOx reductions work. So,
thank you.
I guess the piece I should add is that even though we've moved on and we have a new ozone standard, the Baltimore area, which has historically had one of the country's toughest ozone problems to solve, is actually still measuring attainment levels for the old standard, the 75 ppb standard, which is a pretty good indicator that things are actually going relatively well in Baltimore. Other areas of the country, like Philadelphia and New York, are not measuring attainment of the old 75 ppb standard. So the other new issue is that EPA did finalize the first round of designations for the new SO2 standard. One area in Maryland was designated as non-attainment. It's an area that includes parts of Baltimore County and Anne Arundel County, and it sort of focuses on the area around the Wagner Station power plant. And so we'll have new work to do because of that. I think the good news is there's already controls that are scheduled to go in that are going to help us, we think, make progress. Perhaps, maybe we're already in attainment, but the timing didn't work. But so you're going to be hearing more about the SO2 standard over the course of the next year. So those are my two updates.
Thank you, Ted. So,
Randy, do we want to move to consumer products first?
I think that was probably best.
Do you want to take time to look at the minutes?
Oh, sure, I'm sorry.
Okay, we have the minutes from the June 6, 2016 meeting here. These were sent out ahead of time. Hopefully folks have had a chance to look at them. If not, we'll give you a couple of minutes here and then entertain a motion to accept these into the record.
Detailed minutes.
They get posted on the web.
No.
They get posted on the web.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. I know.
nice to have this accountability.
Okay, any comments? Anyone notice anything that appears to be an error?
I move that we accept the minutes.
Second that.
Very good. All in favor?
Aye.
All the minutes are accepted into the record as printed here. And we'll move on to consumer product regulations.
Good morning, everyone. I just wanted to check one more time. Has anyone joined us on the phone line? Hopefully that's working. I apologize. Today we've experienced technical difficulties, so if there were other council members attempting to join us via webinar, we're not able to connect. So hopefully the phone line is functioning. Today we'll be bringing back before the council the consumer products regulation that we did discuss on June 6, 2016. We're going to briefly just go over the action as was proposed before, and then just give you a little bit more of an in-depth about the California Air Resources Board and the Ozone Transport Commission's rule adoption process, and the importance of that for maintaining regional consistency throughout the area.
Yes, I think it would be useful to review why the council for this issue?
It's partially in the presentation. If we don't get to that in enough depth, please let us know. But I hope we did cover that. So there were a number of questions and comments and concerns that were raised by the council that we addressed through various means. And we hope to address all the comments that were raised as well as our department's responses to that. And then go forward with the updated, revised regulation timeline since we're moving this back several months from where our original proposal was. So again, the purpose of this action is to amend existing regulations under COMAR 261132. Maryland has had consumer product regulations on the books since 2003. This is the third version of those consumer product regulations. We keep on adding new categories and revising standards as California develops new measures for that. Essentially, this particular action will establish VOC standards for 11 new consumer products and strengthen VOC standards for 14 existing categories. The amendments are based upon the 2014 OTC model rule for consumer products. And throughout the course of the year or so, MD has been very much actively working with the Ozone Transport Commission and stakeholders. Stakeholders of which we have here today are supportive of this action. Several states have already adopted or are in the process of adopting this regulation, in particular Delaware, New Hampshire, have gone ahead and have this latest model rule up in place. Compliant consumer products for most of the categories are already readily available and are on the market. A number of types of products just like have a national product in place. So when California develops a rule as they did, this 2014 OTC model rule is based upon earlier California rules going back 2009, in some cases 2006. So a lot of the products are already on the market, but as we're going to discuss, some very big niche categories, which actually make up a wide array of VOC reductions, are still being sold in at a regional nature. So by Maryland adopting these regulations, we'll actually see great benefits coming to the state. And there are, as I mentioned, positive environmental and health benefits associated with us adopting this regulation. I guess I had a lot to say here. I apologize if I did look back at small font. But so we did bring this before the council on June 6, 2016. The council, while generally supporting the concept of the proposed regulation of VOC reductions, asked to defer vote on this action until September 19th, this meeting today. The council requested a two-page summary on the CARB toxic rulemaking process and how it relates to air toxics. So basically just the process that CARB goes through in reviewing and processing and assessing air toxics through their process, how it integrates into the rulemaking process, and ultimately gets into the OTC rules and how a state like Maryland would adopt that. So we did provide, I guess I'm jumping down, on July 22nd, 2016, and we did prepare a document and submit it to the council for their review. Council also requested the department explore proposed regulatory language that we had in place that links Maryland's toxic prohibitions to the current CARB levels. So we did go through that process, and we'll be explaining just what we discovered as we developed that two-page document. So as you can imagine, we did some extensive work on this throughout the summer. We've held numerous phone calls with the Ozone Transport Commission and also talking with our counterparts in CARB. And it was a very good learning experience. While going through a regulation of any kind and working with OTC, we discover a lot as we're going through a regulation, but we really got under the hood with this regulation and learned a lot more about the toxic process and just the regulation in general. So discovering as well a couple of minor edits that made its way into the regulation while we did that. So it was I think it was a prudent exercise. So OTC's 2014 Consumer Product Model Rule and Maryland's current proposed regulations prohibit toxics from 26 consumer product categories, and they match California's prohibitions up to the year 2009. OTC is now gearing up for a Phase 5 Consumer Products Model Rule, and Maryland's going to take a much more active role in this process since our dealings with CARB and what we've learned so far, and just to see that more of the VOC limits and the toxic prohibitions are brought up to date and up to speed, and we'll explain to you why what we discovered in these different categories that CARB has had in place since 2009 that OTC's model rule needs to bring into play. So on June 6th, ACAC asked a number of issues. The council asked that we provide a summary of the amount of VOC estimated in Maryland and the actual consumer product rule benefit. And I think this is appropriate with virtually every regulation we bring before the council, just so you have perspective of what the proposed action will do in terms of emission benefits and what we're looking at in terms of holistically for Maryland, what our emissions are for a particular category, or just in general, what our general knocks are in being a city. So we hope to bring that before you today. Also, that we prepared the high-level two-page summary on the CARB toxic review and rule adoption process, which we did on July 22nd. But we have a few more words to say on that. Also, that we proposed regulatory language that links the consumer product regulation to the current CARB process, and that we provide more detail regarding the artist solvent thinner exemption. So here we have the VOC emissions. This is a 2011 annual man-made VOC emissions for Maryland. total of 124,000 tons per year of VOCs that are emitted. A much larger portion of VOCs come from biojet sources, trees, and other plant life matter. But the category for consumer products falls into this area source category, which makes up 39% of the VOCs total man-made. Of that, consumer products is 14% of the total 100%. So it's quite an expansive amount of the area source category. Other categories include point sources, non-electric generating unit point sources, mobile sources, which on-road and off-road comprise quite a large amount of the VOCs. So we're going to expand into this area, this 39% area source category, in the next slide. So that this total pie now represents the entire 39% pie. And of that, you can see that consumer products pretty much dominates this category, 35% in total, over 17,000 tons per year, 47 tons per day come from consumer products. So today's proposed action will actually address 2,300 tons per year removal.
It's a little hard to read the key, but 23% is which one?
There's 21%, oh, sorry, right. And that's surface coating. So it's other type of coatings, industrial coatings, metal surface parts, architectural and industrial maintenance coatings, pleasure craft coatings, there's a whole host of other surface coatings. So it's sort of related to consumer products, but it's more on the industrial manufacturing side.
And ACAC approved regulations for the architectural industrial maintenance coating piece of that, earlier in the year?
A year,
yes.
Whole year.
Last year, right. About a year ago.
A year ago.
As well as addressing, we've recently, probably seen enough of Hussein and I for some time, addressing the consumer, control technique guidelines from EPA over the past several years. We've adopted about six or seven control technique guidelines that have addressed that 21% category.
Does that also include the marine industry?
Yes. There's pleasure craft coating and also fiberglass boat manufacturing.
And that's part of the 21% surface coating category?
Yeah.
Correct.
Thank you.
Has anyone joined us on the phone line?
I'm joined in. This is Sarah.
Sarah Tomlinson? Oh, great. Thank you. So in summary, pie charts in small font is difficult to comprehend. The 2011 consumer products made up 35% of the area source VOC emissions. This regulation will result in a reduction of over 13% or 6.3 tons per day of VOCs. So that's not an insignificant amount. I mean, the majority of the VOC regulations we've brought before the council have been minuscule in terms of reduction. So this is actually quite a large reduction. And I think it's important, as you know, Tad has stressed over the years, you know, NOx is what really matters for our air quality, for our ozone, and a lot of the other issues. But VOC is very tangible in an immediate effect, as well as for people utilizing these products, both in the household and for commercial living themselves, those who are janitorial or other type of work. So the toxic prohibitions as well as the VOC reductions are very beneficial in terms of health protections. And again, though carb-compliant products are already in the market from nationwide manufacturers, the Maryland VOC emissions benefits line companies who sell their products regionally or solely in the state of Maryland. So there are a number, especially in the categories like multi-purpose solvents and the paint thinners, that there's a lot of local, regional type products that are sold in the area. So the adoption of this regulation is going to have them need to meet the more strict California standards, as well as the toxic prohibitions that come along with that. So as we dug further and further into the CAR procedures to prepare this two-page summary for you, some of the main findings that we uncovered were that the California's Clean Air Act requires that CAR develop regulations that achieve maximum VOC benefits while being commercially and technologically feasible. So very much like EPA's RAC type standard, reasonably available control technology. So it takes into account the feasibility of the manufacturers to transition over to these standards while they go through the review process. They do extensive surveys that look into just how the products are being utilized, what components are going into them, what type of hats or other constituents make up those products. And CARB has extensive staff compared to most states, so that's why they're able to do such an exhaustive process in reviewing all of these products. CARB identifies and monitors the use of toxic air contaminants in their consumer products. They survey the manufacturers for their current use of VOCs and toxics, greenhouse gases, and other chemicals. And the CARB regulations prohibit the use of fluorinated compounds as well as paradichlorobenzene, which our Maryland regulations do as well. We adopted that in the first version of consumer products reg for antiperspirants for products that actually go on the human body. Something else I wanted to say in here. So very straightforward and linear process as to how the regulation comes to Maryland. CARB traditionally for consumer products rules develops these rules. The Ozone Transport Commission reviews CARB updates and they develop a consumer product model rule based very, very closely upon the CARB rules. OTC is not a body unto itself. It's made up of state representatives, including Maryland. So we're a part of this process that reviews CARB regs and make sure that the OTC rule is reflective of that. And then MD adopts these OTC consumer product model rules. In that process, we have to go back and sometimes make minor amendments to definitions or format and structure of these regulations so they fit into the Maryland's Division of State Documents requirements for developing them. So that's a sort of a painstaking process that we do with any OTC model rule. This proposed action today, again, it's based on the OTC 2014 model rule, which pulls into play the 2006 and 2009 CARB updates to their model rule. And again, OTC is currently in the process of just kick-starting reviewing a phase 5 model rule to catch more up to speed with a lot of the rework that's been going on through the CARB process. And to throw another curveball into it, right as we're having this big toxic discussion and having considerations about Maryland potentially making updates to our toxic prohibitions to address the CAR model rule, EPA came out with the Toxic Substance Control Act, of which we've delved into to, again, yet another painstaking level. We've worked very closely with our Attorney General's office and learned about the potential impacts that'll have on Maryland moving forward to adopt and address toxic protections throughout a number of regulations. I'm going to turn this slide over to Megan Ulrich, who's our legislative liaison with our group, and she can understand the meter of this the law much better than I can.
So as Randy said, President Obama adopted the UCASCO reform bill into law on June 22nd. And under the new law, states can be preempted if EPA has taken action on a certain chemical. Now, Maryland has several options to be exempt from the preemption. One of them includes if the rule is adopted under another federal law, such as the Clean Air Act, which applies to our regulations that we do in ARMA. The other exemption to preemption that could be applicable is that our regulations were adopted under state law that was enacted prior to August 31st, 2003. So at this point, we feel comfortable moving forward with these regulations, and if we would need to, we could argue one of those exceptions to preemption. However, EPA has not proposed any new rules yet under the reform bill. They are looking at doing a proposed rule for TCE for aerosol degreasing and spot cleaning. And they're also looking at another proposed rule for methylene chloride and methylene chloride in paint removers. So we're going to continue to monitor these rules and make sure that they won't have any effect on our future regulations.
So maybe a bottom line to take home from that is that what we are currently proposing, we do not believe the PASCA rule has any impact upon us adopting what we are proposing. We were worried about that at first, that it seemed to be getting into an area that we may not be able to move forward with our existing rule. That doesn't appear to be the case.
So just to clarify, so we're strengthening some aspects of a rule that was in place prior to 2003?
Correct.
So therefore, we believe, because that old rule was in effect, we believe these strengthenings are exempt from the preemption.
So the rule that was in effect prior to 2003 is actually in statute. So that's where the exemption comes into play, is that if you have a state statute in effect, then you can adopt regulations under it and amend them in the future.
Interesting. And I assume California and other states are in a similar situation.
I believe California is generally in a similar situation. However, they have taken some new actions, specifically on the methylene chloride. So they are, I think, looking into that to see if they're affected at all by PASCA right now.
And there are no results from test cases yet?
No.
I think that the task of the preemption was for 2003, and that was when, I think it was August 31, 2003, and Maryland's consumer product rule came into adoption August 11, 2003. So we just got in under the wire with that.
Wow.
But I think there was also, the preemption is broader in the sense that the Clean Air Act gives the state the authority to just set the protections and whatever for NOx and VOCs. So just that alone is a potential preemption as well,
right,
if I'm getting it right. So despite our consumer product reg, there's also that broader preemption protection. I'm trying to understand. She really knows much better, but that's my best understanding.
Yeah.
For the Clean Air Act, is that the Maryland Clean Air Act or the federal?
No, the federal Clean Air Act.
So that would apply to all the states then?
Correct, yeah. As long as it's another federal law that you're adopting the rules under, then you'd be preempted.
So the Maryland rules the healthier act?
Yes.
One of our, yes.
Yeah.
And that was a legislative authority to adopt a rule.
Thank you, Ms. Excellent.
Thank you, Megan. I didn't have to go through that one myself. One of the other product categories you asked us to look more closely into, just because of the propensity of art schools throughout the state, was the artisol and thinner exemption that's provided in the rule. So looking into this further, we discovered that CARB conducted an extensive survey, again, for the paint thinner category, including artisol and thinners. Within the paint thinner category, the proportion of artisol and thinner that made up that broad category was considered minuscule. We didn't get actual numbers on it, but it was very, very small. What's also in place and what the CARB will require was ASTM D4236, which is being proposed and adopted in Maryland's regulation as well. It requires that any art material, including solvents, meet the standards to protect consumers of any age from potential health hazards of these products. The standard additionally requires that the art material be reviewed by a board certified or qualified toxicologist and labeled consistent with the standard. That's kind of reminding me what I I want to say just in general about the entire toxic prohibitions that go through the CARB process, that it's a very open, not only are they serving manufacturers, but they're also holding these public hearings. There's a lot of accountability that's and public pressure that comes from doing this. So when a particular product may reformulate from an existing HAP or banned toxic, they're less prone to transition over to maybe another substance that would be a HAP as well. Generally, it's just all going towards acetone-based and other non-toxic constituents making up these products. And we found that to be the case just in reviewing the artist solid thinner category as well. Not only talking with CARB, was it their discussion with us that because of the public pressure, even though there's an exemption for the smaller size under 32 ounce, that the majority of the artist solid thinners were already making the transition over to less toxic nature. And in doing just our own review and looking through this category on our own, it was hard to find a product that contained a toxic compound in it. So it just seems like naturally they're transitioning over to that as well. There's also an extensive what they discovered as well, the cost discrepancy between artist solvent thinner and a traditional paint thinner is dramatic. So you're not going to get any paint companies coming in and buying huge amounts of artist solvent thinner to circumvent the rule because it's cost prohibitive. So that's just another thing that CARB has got all this information in place. It was just important to leave it in as is. So there may be certain instances for artists that they need the traditional artist solvent thinner and they didn't want to upset that rule for now. Maybe it'll be something addressed in the future. As these new products demonstrate their ability to perform just as well, which is the case with a lot of types of products. Please.
So, I mean, I get that we're looking really at global air emissions and not personal safety. Sometimes we look at that as an ancillary benefit to what we do. But I question that second one, given the scope of this ASTM standard that I'm looking at. It looks to me like it's about labeling so that people can do things to protect themselves. It's not, and they specifically say in the scope, they don't have test methods for determining whether it presents a product or substance presents chronic health hazards. So
it is labeling, but the additional CARB step of making it go through the toxicological review, again, I think they feel that they've determined that the traditional artist solvent thinner has health concerns associated with it, and it needs to be labeled as such. So they're just at least buyer beware type of a thing going out there. But again, I searched, and a lot of the products are really seeming to migrate over to a healthier version. So that's anecdotal, but it's promising. So we will dig into that further. So here we are. The timeline has been adjusted a bit. We've had our first stakeholder meeting we held on April 5th. We received stakeholder comments from a number of sources on April 22nd. We worked to integrate those comments into the regulation. Then we held a second stakeholder meeting on May 17th, presented it to the council on June 6th. We prepared our toxic summary and gave it to the council on July 22nd. Here we are today on the 19th. If we adopt and propose this regulation moving forward, we'll have the proposed action announced just before the Department of Division of State documents cut off. And have it in the Maryland Register on December 23rd. Moving into a tentative public hearing of January 23rd and a final reg adoption of March 23rd. So that would give us a regulation compliance. compliance date that we have set hard in the rule itself of January 1, 2018, which again, we received support of pushing that compliance date back from industry, and it makes sense, especially in the light of us pushing the regulation back to today. So hopefully any questions we can try to answer them. I hope a lot of the documents provided earlier address a number of your concerns as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Randy. Can I ask the two council members who joined us during Randy's talk to introduce themselves for the record?
Sure. Good morning. Todd Chasen on behalf of the Maryland Chamber of Commerce.
And it's Sarah.
And it's Sarah Thomas.
I'm Tim Shepard, Maryland. Oh, I'm sorry. Sarah Thomas.
Sarah, are you still on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent. Thank you. And that gives us eight council members today, so we can move on to the first agenda item.
We'll tell you, I need to leave it. I have to leave at 10:30. So.
10:30. Okay. Hopefully, we're keeping close to the schedule today.
I also have to leave at that time.
But I could actually keep my phone on. Try that.
So we open the floor to further discussion about this proposed rule. Are there any questions or comments on the materials provided so far to supplement the discussion in the last meeting? Any other concerns expressed last time not been addressed?
I thank the MDU for doing this. It makes it much more understandable for us. So all of the numbers here are the numbers from Carver on the table?
Yes.
Randy, just to clarify, 6.3 tons is an additional reduction, not counting the products that Orbit had formed nationally.
Inclusive. But a large percentage of the 6.3 tons, a good bit of that multi-purpose solid paint thinner category. So we feel we're getting a big percentage of this reduction. We were going through and line by line trying to identify the cost and reductions associated with each category. So we didn't fully accomplish that effort, but we did find that multi-purpose solids made up a good percentage of that. Is that
12%? Of the between the 13 and 15% of the overall rule, it's between 8 and 10%, the paint thinner and multi-solvent reduction. They're going somewhere from like an 80% by weight down to a 3. So CARB had transitioned it from 80 down to 30, and then now they're down at 3 recently.
So the NA thing that I commented on last time, do anything about that?
Yes.
I don't know.
This one. That was in the table itself. Oh, at the bottom of the table, the not applicable within, or is it within the table itself?
No, I think it was just that it was covered by another regulation. It wasn't that we removed applicability completely, right? It was not the, because you have placed on the table where there was a limit in 08, in 05.
Yeah, under automotive brake cleaners, we have a NA in the current category, but that's because it gets covered. Relocated?
A number of the products were renamed to different, so NAs went into the table, what they used to be, and now they're just considered brake cleaner, so there's no longer standard applying to that. And there are a couple to explain that in her fact sheet, provide that information there, rather than cluttering up the regulation sometimes with.
Right, and the fact sheet did have little symbols to address whether it was a rename or if it was a new category or not.
The realignment of the categories based on industry comments.
Again, I think maybe we discussed this last time, but you know, CARB is basically focusing on health risks. And I guess I'm just, in this surveys with manufacturers is the issue of how well those products perform as a substitution. Is that part of the CARB process, or is that part of feedback that comes from manufacturers, or is that not even considered?
It's certainly part of the survey process that performance of products comes into play. Again, we do have industry representatives here today who could speak to the council on that issue again, but it is certainly part of the process.
Yeah, and it's the regulatory group, as like our peers at CARB, that would be doing that part, and there's a separate health risk association that does the health risk first and that establishes the TAC list, and then when they do the reformulation, it's all about product function and removing the toxics if they can. So that part is all part of the survey.
Mr. Yost or Mr. Call, if you have any further comments about that?
Yes, if I may just address the issue. CARB does conduct very extensive surveys. They're currently in the process of conducting three separate surveys, 2014, 2015. Massive surveys to look at formulation, and also to answer your question, sir, the issue of how the product works. As was stated by Mr. Moser, the California Clean Air Act requires that the limits be technologically and commercially feasible. That gets to the issue of if they work, and work as well. By and large, they work almost as well, and they are certainly commercially feasible. And technically challenging limits that CARB comes up with, and those limits are now being adopted here in Maryland as following the Ozone Transport Commission's model rule. So CARB does extensive research, and it makes sense that the OTC and, by extension, Maryland Department of Environment build off of that. No sense to reinvent the wheel. CARB has roughly 60, and this is a number that CARB cited several years ago, 67 full-time equivalent staff working on consumer products and architectural coding regulations. So that's a massive array of very bright, very hardworking people. And so it makes sense to use that information to base Maryland's action on these particular products.
So kind of just to paraphrase, like, it seems like a lot of the reductions are coming out of thinners for a lot of these that we're talking about. Thinners are a large component of this whole category.
The solvents and the thinners, yes.
The industry in general is favorable with regards to how the new products perform.
I'm Heidi McCollum from the American Coatings Association, and I agree with everything Joe said. And the only comment I would add on the efficacy issue is part of the survey process, the ARB looks at the market share for all of the products that are reported. So, you know, they know what product only has 1% of the market, what product has 29% of the market, what product has a greater share of the marketplace. And that's one of the ways that they evaluate efficacy of the products. I mean, we know they're working because consumers buy them. You know, one evidence that a product is not working is it doesn't have any market share. And in addition to that, Joe with the Consumer Specialty Products Association, myself with American Coatings Association, and several other trade associations will march in the ARB, and we actually do product demonstrations for them as well. So there's a very heavy emphasis on efficacy of these products. Not to mention the fact that Joe indicated it's a statutory requirement in California. Technological efficacy is required for ARB to look at. So.
Okay, thanks.
Appreciate it.
All
Also, the regulation is unique that it has a special section for innovative products, and there is a special regulation for variation, and there's a special regulation for alternative compliance plans. So it offers manufacturers a lot of flexibility to come into compliance. They can have a product that is exceeding some of the standards, but if they combine all their products, they meet the overall requirement for reduction. So it's a very flexible approach that encourages new product development without any hindrance based on the standards.
I don't want to drag it out, but I'm just curious with regards to that process that takes place. Does it occur where there want to be reductions made, but the products that are trying to be replaced or reformulated don't work, and those standards are not the changes aren't made? Does that occur very often, or does technology allow those products to be developed?
Good question. What CARB does is it does a very close analysis of the potential of any products that can come into the market, studies the feasibility and the projects, and allows a certain time period for time to experiment and test and then comply with the standard. So it already ensures that there are products available that can meet the demand first before proposing a standard. They already know that certain products are available, they can meet the market demand, and then they go ahead and propose it. It's a very intricate, involved process with the industry that they continue over the period of time, that is 25 years. And as a result of this analysis, they are able to accurately project what a potential technology can do, how long it will take to come to the market, what stage it is at, and then establish a proposal that all stakeholders agree upon. These manufacturers basically agree. It's just that, you know, the user requires some time to adjust to the new product, and they need to get comfortable with it, you know, utilize it on a regular basis. So the regulation pushes them in that direction. It's more focused on the user adapting their process to the product versus whether the product can work or not. That already has been determined at the time of the proposal development.
I can always ask more questions.
Any other questions, concerns, further discussion? We have a motion to accept the rule.
So
second. All in favor?
On the phone, sir.
And on the phone?
Yeah. This is Sarah.
Are you in favor, Sarah?
Yes, I'm in favor.
Thank you. Well, thank you all.
Yeah.
Now that we're past the, I was going to bring this up earlier, but I didn't want to generate discussion. But some of our more recent research, and Ross's folks are doing a lot of this, is starting to send us a clear message that that VOCs really is important, particularly for some days in some areas, and that yes, NOx has been the workhorse for a long time, but we're getting to the point where our problems are sort of more complicated and intricate, and about the weather on days and the location, and VOCs is actually really starting to jump out as something that is really perhaps we perhaps undersold its benefits in the past. So anyway.
Just have to keep the artist indoors. Yeah.
So, ma'am, should we go back to the first agenda?
That will be wonderful. So, just as a preface, Megan will be going through the proposed amendment to the ACAC bylaws. As a reminder to the council, and it may be in the presentation, sorry if I'm stealing any thunder, but we did have this discussion with the council back in 2007. About certain aspects of the bylaws. There were several discussions that were held over the course of the meeting. And we've always had this on the back burner, knowing we had to address these issues and bring it back before the council. And going through that process, Megan and I sat down and noticed a number of other areas that just hadn't been addressed. So Megan, I'll be meeting you
also work to conform the bylaws more closely with Robert's Rules of Order. And they go into more detail on the role of the chair, meeting attendance, and voting rights. So one of the first areas that we expanded upon, per an environmental article, the Secretary of the Environment appoints the chairperson and the vice chairperson to the council. And the secretary may consult with the chairperson on the appointment of a vice chair. This other part, which I'm not going to go through completely, but it's where we added in pretty standard responsibilities of the chairperson, such as calling the meeting to order, announcing the business before the council, recognizing members entitled to the floor, and place to vote all motions which are regularly moved. If the chairperson is not able to attend a meeting, the vice chairperson will assume the responsibilities of the chair. In meeting attendance, we added a few things that were just kind of to be a more scape of modern technology, such that council members may attend meetings by phone or webinar. If a council member cannot attend at least 50% of the meetings during any period of 12 consecutive months, or if they miss more than two consecutive meetings, then there is a process we put into place where the chairperson will contact that member and discuss the reason for the member's absence. Based on that conversation, if the member continues to have unsatisfactory attendance, the director of ARMA may recommend appointing a successor the remainder of the member's term to the Secretary of the Environment. And extenuating circumstances may be considered as to whether or not a successor would be appointed. The last area that we need some updates to was voting. Council members may vote in person, by phone, or via webinar. And voting rights are limited to council members only or proxy parties, one of the things we added in. And if a council member wishes to designate a proxy, then prior to the start of each meeting, the council member shall forward the name of the proxy to the chairperson. The proxy should have all the same rights as the council member for the duration of that meeting only. So therefore, if you want to designate a proxy for the December meeting, and then another one for the following meeting, you would need to redesignate it for each meeting, so it's not a lasting designation. And finally, council members may vote in the affirmative, negative, or abstain from voting. We added that the chairperson protects impartiality by exercising voting rights only when his or her vote would affect the outcome. In such cases, the chair can either vote and her vote would affect the outcome, or the chair can abstain and thereby change the result. Change the result by voting. If the chair abstains, he announces the result of the vote with no mention of his or her own vote. And should the vote result in a tie, no recommendation would be made to the department. Any questions?
A couple questions. The proxy, if a member decides to have a proxy, then the member just appoints, they tell the chair. There is no process that the proxy is accepted, or if the member says, I don't need a proxy, that's it?
Correct. The member would email the chair prior to the start of the council meeting.
And that takes care of it. You know, there's not any approval of the proxy.
No, not as it's currently written.
Okay. Second question. If someone abstains, do they need to indicate why?
No.
So I'm going to express some discomfort with the proxy process as it's written. Given that we've allowed people to attend by webinar, where you can actually hear the discussion, and there is some institutional memory and working relationships that develop on the committee, and I'm not sure that that's properly served by a proxy person who comes in. And it seems to me that the webinar process really does broaden the ability to attend. What I might suggest is, instead of the proxy process, or maybe in separate consideration, I work on some committees where there's a letter ballot process, or a member of the committee just can't get there either by webinar or in person, and if they, and at the discretion of the chair, their ability to vote can be extended after the meeting by letter or email, essentially, these days. So anyway, that's my discomfort with the proxy.
I, too, will talk about the proxy, so I think it looks like we have issues with that. What I was going to say about it, but I'm happy to back what Larry said and suggest we just do away with the proxy, but if we keep it, it's, in my opinion, essential that we limit one person per proxy, which is what, so in my, not that it really matters, but in my departments, two departments, University of Maryland, one prohibits proxies absolutely. It's like you got to be here and discuss it or you don't get a vote, but they do allow a written vote if, like, but there, like, the written vote has to be in place prior to the in-person vote, so when the vote's taken, you know if it passed or not. You just know. But the other department allows a proxy, but only one person per proxy. And the importance of that is you can't build a you can't come in here with five votes, or I can't, or me, I can't come in here with five votes and fully everyone. I got four proxies. Four people aren't, you know, so my opinion counts five times than anybody, they don't want that. So if we keep the proxy, in my opinion, it's essential one person per proxy, but I'm happy to do whatever.
More so that, what's the definition? Who can be proxies? Another member or somebody from the outside? Who's going to be the proxy? That's the main thing.
I just would like to add that the department or our group reviewed this and considered this as something we thought we were accommodating a need that the council had requested at some point. And hearing that there's some discomfort with it, we're completely fine with migrating away from that. We did put this forward as just something that we thought that was a desire from the council and not so much a desire for the department to have this as a motion.
Thank you.
With that just being a preface.
Hearing the discussion, I'm really not leaning towards proxy at all. I think the webinar and the phone voting takes care of that issue. I'm really uncomfortable with having a letter ballot. You'd want to know right away what the answer, what the vote was. But then in that case, if you voted, if you had a letter vote before you heard the discussion, well then, why, you know, that doesn't make any sense to me. I think we need to learn to hear the discussion. So it seems to me the phone and the webinar takes care of that. And today, how many members on this council are there? We only needed eight for an official vote.
15.
So I would think that the webinar and the phone could, you could still get a quorum. Needs to be cut majority.
Well, I was involved in this specifically last year with a vote where I wasn't able to attend, and I sent Todd a message ahead of time indicating that I was in favor of this particular issue being accepted, but we didn't have a means through the bylaws to accept that vote. Personally, I would be open to Larry's suggestion about the member registering their position about one or more issues that way in writing before the meeting instead of proxy. But the point about the engagement and the discussion is a good one as well.
It's a tough issue.
Can I weigh in?
Please do.
This is Sarah on the phone for Tomlinson.
Yeah, yes. Go ahead.
So I support the idea of having a proxy. You know, if the organization, I mean, if the person on the council is a member of an organization like I am, who would have a proxy already set up, who is Russ Ulrich, who I work with. So if I wasn't able to come, then he would be able to come and vote, and we would discuss ahead of time. And I would leave that up to him. So I support the idea of a proxy for people who are comfortable with that.
So a couple of ideas about how some of the other committees I work on, they have an organizational alternate who's pre-approved, somebody who is up to speed on the work of the council and maybe attends from time to time. So there is some of that working relationship. The other thought is if you put in for the letter ballot the discretion of the chair, it doesn't give full protection to address your issue letter, but it's at least the chair can say, well, you know, there were a lot of new information presented at the meeting. I don't think the letter ballot before this meeting is, you know, the person might reconsider it with all that information. So at least give some kind of out.
What I was going to say about the letter ballot is, you know, the MDE gives fantastic information ahead of time. The information for this meeting was sent about 2 weeks ago with attachments. And so I could kind of go both ways. You know, if someone really can't be here but attests that they reviewed the material and they have a strong position, I could kind of see that if, you know, I mean, I believe them if they said they reviewed the material. And that's how it works. In my department doesn't allow proxies. They do allow people to vote ahead of time, but they have to have, you know, like a tenure package. They have to write it to, you know, make a judgment. So I'm teetering back and forth on this, but I wonder how people feel if we have a written vote ahead of time where the person attests that they've gone through the material. So it can only be given after the material has been put out. And if the material hasn't been put out ahead of time, then it's just not allowed. Is that comfort or is that still not good?
The thing is, though, that since I've been here, stuff has been put out, but then it's generated a lot of conversation and discussion. And, you know, I do promotion and tenure too, and you can't vote unless you're there for the discussion, at least in our department. So, and I just wonder about that, because there have been some contentious things that come up that generate a lot of discussion. I'm just wondering if not being there and having the letter, you looked at this stuff and stuff you didn't think about.
Ways, yeah. Yep.
For the risk of being very unpopular here, the meeting is only 3 or 4 times a year. It's not like every month. We have sometimes meeting every month. So how difficult it is to be able to be either on the phone for the time of the vote, for the discussion, or I'm not sure, having a proxy all the time to come and vote for you. So don't be on the committee, period, on the council. It's a 3 or 4 times a year. It's not every month. We all serve on committee on a monthly basis or weekly basis. So we can say no, we cannot do it. I mean, it's not like every month. It's 3 times a year, 4 times a year.
Randy, if I can ask a question, it seems like there's two measures in the proposed changes that are designed to facilitate the business of the council getting done. One is related to the proxy, and the other is related to attendance performance. Is there a history that can tell us that says that although we normally have 15 council members, our average attendance is such that we're not able to complete the business of the council because of that?
Correct. Historically, there are times where we've been concerned about having a quorum present. It is always a challenge. Since I have been examining the council, we have not had a full council, but for very narrow windows of time. There are 15 members. It's very difficult to keep us a serving member in every position. Right now, we are 2 members short. So it's always an ongoing process of addressing that. In addition to the membership and the proxy, we also try to enhance the ability of council members to have a full vote by adding in the webinar. Since that's today was a bad example of demonstrating the feasibility of that, and by phone vote having those count and being demonstrated in the bylaws. So we were just trying to do a number of measures that would ensure a quorum. And we do understand and note the challenges that a proxy may present. If there's a workaround to that, or if we just wish I don't speak to the council's decision, but we were just trying to address some of those issues.
I just don't see how you can, a person's got to be involved here in one way or another to hear the discussion, to vote. So I can't see how someone can submit a letter with looking at materials. I know if we talked, that your idea, but, and if it's going to be a proxy, that, it just seems to, you know, I don't know, I haven't been involved with this long, but if it's something contentious or whatever, then people can kind of just, you know, submit letters or whatever. It just seems like you have to be here some way for discussion, so then the question is, can a proxy fill that? And unless that person is qualified in some way, I'm not sure how you do that. Either by like a letter or something, that agreement by the chairman or something. It seems that would be part of that qualification. But like you said too, there's a couple meetings. I'm coming from Hagerstown. You know, I could roll out of bed and be on the phone much better, easier than I could drive here. So if you agree to be on something, I think you ought to commit to it.
You're in favor of full engagement with the process as opposed to unless any of the proxy alternatives?
Unless there's some way to qualify who the proxy is. And I think that's got to be the issue in some cases.
If the body's not careful, it runs the risk of, by paralysis, losing its importance. If we can't actually operate on a regular basis, it becomes a problem. I think the flexibility is important. I understand and agree with the concerns. I wonder whether giving the chair some discretion on which notes would be allowed by proxy and providing some advanced notice, so that might be the way around. There are a lot of routine things that also get voted that don't necessarily require a great deal of discussion or understanding at the time. If there are particular issues that are coming up, perhaps those issues would be flagged. This is not a proxy vote. You're either here or you don't get to weigh in, but we do have to make sure that we're able to operate the way we do.
But I can't remember a situation where we were unable to act because of lack of attendance. I just can't remember one.
Not sure I do either. That's what I was asking Randy.
So in response to Randy's comment that right now we have a couple of vacancies, another way to handle that would be, rather than putting in absolute numbers for 8 makes a quorum, just simply state that it's a majority of the currently appointed members. So that if we only have a roster of 13.
The quorum is 5, and that's easier than, okay. That's easier than the majority.
All right, but there was something in there about 8.
For passage of bylaws, it's 8 council members.
Oh.
Okay, so maybe that's not a bad idea.
What's the current rule of passage of bylaws before we make any changes? So we need to have 8. Do we have 8 here today?
Yes.
With Sarah.
Mm-hmm. But everyone's vote is important. Because we only have 8.
Right.
True. And one thing we did add in as well is, I think the current bylaws, it was just a 7-day notification from the department if there were changes to be proposed, and we added it to keep it consistent with just the 14 days, which is how we prepare materials for the council review, so we wanted to ensure that there was adequate time to review.
All right, so I also want to point out that there is a standing rules process at the very end of the bylaws. So we don't have to have everything in the bylaws. I think we can have things that maybe ought to be a little bit more fluid in standing rules.
Todd was suggesting. Yeah. It sounds like there's a consensus of opinion that a proxy approach to absent members voting is not favored. I don't hear anybody saying they're comfortable with that.
No, I actually support having a proxy if organizations.
I'm sorry.
Sarah, I actually support the proxy idea.
I think that it's been a while since these bylaws were tried to be changed, and now we have an opportunity to do it. And at this point, we're adding, I think, 2 important technological advances, phones and webinars, and let's see how that works before we do anything more drastic like proxies and letters that allow the chair to decide which is good and which is not. I have a little uncomfortability with that. So I would make the motion to adopt these bylaws minus the item about proxies.
Any further discussion about that?
Well, before I before I even consider seconding, I wanted to see if maybe we should sort of draft up the language, have staff draft up the language, see what it would look like both ways. I hate to do editing on the fly.
Oh, okay, I agree with that. I would just, maybe my motion would be to ask staff to redraft the line of the law.
So we can at least see it next time and then make a choice.
So we were just looking at that, actually, and the change would be under C, which is voting, we would describe number two, because that's where the proxy actually comes into play. And then we would move three up to two, it's the number.
So it is that simple? There's no place else in the document where proxy is mentioned?
So the possibility of a letter vote, is that in the context of Todd's comment about the discretion of the chair, something that's would still be possible in these bylaws without that paragraph? About the proxy?
Understanding rules potentially, the chair is composed of majority agree. I think that should take place when it has to be based.
Yeah, it's not in the bylaws.
I have two things. So first off, I like striking C2. C1 says council members may vote in person, by phone, or by webinar, but it doesn't say may only vote. So if we should discuss whether to put only there. We should discuss that. And then my other point is for standing rules, so where that last page where it says standing rules, so y'all are doing a great job. Don't take this the wrong way. This is awesome. But I hate double negative. Standing rules are not inconsistent. What? Shouldn't we just say standing rules are consistent with the bylaws? Okay? Shouldn't we just say that?
Somebody drafted that years ago. So anything in black is already there.
Yeah.
But we hear you.
Okay, so check this out. If we say standing rules...
Understand there's a difference, though, between... The double negative does make a difference.
I got it.
So...
But just that we are doing all of that?
Being very clear that there's a difference between being consistent with them and being not inconsistent with them.
Thanks, Todd. So here's where I'm going with that. Thanks, Todd. So if we change it to say consistent, and then we put the word only in one, then we have removed the ability... or a proxy vote or letter vote. We're very clear. If you don't put only in, there's a little bit of wiggle room.
Yeah.
A little bit of wiggle room. So what do we want to do?
Ross, you're saying you favor putting the word only in there?
I'm in favor of us being clear about what we want to do.
Well, we could say only, and we could add under voting, and if the council adopts standing rules for letter ballot, then by letter ballot as well.
I don't think, just counting the votes, I don't think we have 8 votes
for the letter ballot
to make this happen. So I would move to lay this over until the next meeting. So there could be some discussion via email and some drafts we go back.
We do have 8, don't we?
And try to...
Well, I think Todd's saying we have eight members, but not 8 folks of a similar mind.
If that's a motion, I would second the motion to postpone with that item of information that we kind of like to see it without. Well, it's pretty simple.
Let's be specific about what we're proposing. They revisit the paragraph 2 under C. Is anyone in disagreement about striking that?
I think Sarah was.
Sarah
was, yeah.
Sarah, do you favor that we continue to maintain the option of a proxy vote?
Yes, I'd like to maintain it.
Hey, Sarah, this is Ross. What I heard you say was that you're in favor of having someone from your institution serve in your place. And to me, we could talk about that. That's a different than a proxy vote. A proxy vote is very broad. You know, I can give anybody who I want my proxy. Whereas what you said is very narrow, someone from your institution be an alternate. So maybe if I heard you correctly, should we just pursue that for the next time we discuss it? Perhaps having someone who's vetted, who can kind of, rotate or substitute, but, you know, do they have to be vetted? Do they just have to be from the institution? Would you be comfortable, Sarah, if that's how the discussion went next time as opposed to the keyword proxy?
Yeah, I would support a process where you could tell them, you know, months ahead of time, this is my alternate if I'm not there. I would support that.
Yeah, Ross, you're saying that the criteria for an acceptable representative for a member would be more defined?
Well, we have to have some rules. I don't know if it needs, I'm not making a suggestion. I don't know if it needs approval by the secretary or if it just has to be approved by the chair of someone from the institute. You know, Sarah's from the regional planning council, or someone else from the council. If I can't make it, do I get someone else from my department who has similar credentials to stand in for me? I'm not suggesting what we do. I just want to have the discussion focus on what Sarah really said. Because believe me, I know there's value in having the same people here. We get to know each other. We have a rhythm. And so just having, you know, random people show up you've never seen before gets in the way of progress sometimes. On the other hand, sometimes it's just practical.
So, Sarah, if based on Ross's suggestion, can you describe some words that would be acceptable to you for the department to consider in revisiting this?
I was okay with the word proxy, but if you guys aren't, you know, if one of you isn't comfortable with that, that's fine. As long as, the department would allow for an alternate to take place of the member when voting, when the member isn't able to attend the meeting. If you guys want to add pre-designated alternate, that works for me too.
Okay.
Good suggestion.
I don't feel the need to add any stipulations, but if you all need to, I understand that.
Okay.
So, we can try this one back.
Well, before we take the motion on the second, we're just trying to solidify what it is we're moving to do.
I think all of the to go to Eve is simple. First, we're moving to postpone, and that's the motion that I think is open. Do that, and then we can talk about what instruction. I think that's the second. We just need to.
Fair enough. Thank you. Okay, let's have a show of hands for postponing this change to the bylaws and revisiting it.
Always wanted
to have
Sarah.
Down the road.
Sarah, the council has all voted in favor of postponing the vote.
Vote would be? Yes, I'm in favor.
Thank you, John.
Okay, now, do we have consensus about whether or not number one should change to say may only vote? What do people think? The next time we see it, what would people like to see for discussion?
Well, that would depend upon whether there was some language about an alternate or something, I think.
So, let me just jump in for another second. I also want to see us get to the rest of our agenda here. I think the drafting by committee in person is probably not a very good use of time. And what I would suggest is that we take advantage of this new technology that we've discovered of electronic mail and have these go in. Of course, we're 8 of now 13 members, and we're going to be voting on this next time. And there may be other or different members who are present. I think there may be other issues that come besides just the proxy as well that we can't foresee. So I would suggest staff sending around an email to all of the members outlining the disagreement or the proxy issue, representing some new language on that, and soliciting by a date certain comments back on that and any other issues. So we can try to get as much of this done in the email ahead of time to this point for the vote.
Is that
all right?
Okay. All right, shall we move on? Next agenda item is the CalLab amendments. can be presented by Justin Mabry.
While Justin's getting set up, we bring amendments to our California car regs to you all several times a year. It's interesting, but it's also fairly routine. We are a California car state, and when California makes amendments to its California car program, we have to make those changes in our rules. So that's the overarching background. We do this a lot, and that's an interesting piece because it's a technology. California car program is a technology-forcing regulatory program. So when we find out the question earlier about have you gone too far, they will routinely make changes to make sure they haven't gone too far too fast. And that's why we bring these to you, probably two to three times a year, once or twice a year.
Just to make sure my understanding is clear, our other choice, if we don't stay in sync with California, is to go back to
the EPA. Yeah, the only two choices on the Clean Air Act, you do the federal car program, you do the California car program, you cannot create a third car. So this is a relatively routine thing we do, but like I said, it's also interesting.
A little bit of background about the Maryland Clean Cars Program. Maryland adopted in 2007, they adopted the California Low Emission Vehicle Program through incorporation by reference of the references of the California regulations. It applies to new motor vehicles registered in Maryland up to 14,000 pounds, so light duty and medium duty up to 14,000 pounds. The purpose of today's update is in order to retain California standards, we have to retain the consistent with what California has done, hence when they update their regulations, we have to collect that changes in our amendments. The changes only impact COMAR 2611-342, which are the incorporated reference. The first update is to the alternative fuel conversion kit. California has made updated the provisions for alternative fuel conversion kits, compressed natural gas, propane, in an effort to increase the availability of CARB certified kits. They have a much more stringent way of certifying the kits versus the EPA regulations. They streamline approval for requirements for small volume manufacturers who produce the alternative fuel conversion kits. They have added additional time to sell these new versions as new vehicles. These changes will make the process quicker and cheaper for the manufacturers and will increase the number of available kits on the market. The next amendment was to the Zero Emission Vehicle Program. The amendments provide intermediate volume manufacturers with greater flexibility to meet the ZEV requirements. California added a global revenue test of $40 billion on top of the volume requirements for 2018 and 2019 in terms of if a manufacturer falls under the intermediate volume manufacturer status or if they would become a small volume manufacturer who doesn't have a requirement for the Zero Emission Vehicle Program. They also extended the lead time from 3 years to 5 years for IBMs to bring plug-ins to market, which helps them develop their cars knowing that the process for developing a new vehicle takes a number of years. California also added a way for the IBMs to adopt the optional compliance path, which was a way for manufacturers to give flexibility in meeting the ZEV requirements. If a manufacturer places ZEVs, extra ZEVs, in Section 177 states who have adopted the Zero Emission Vehicle Program, in the 2 years prior to becoming a large volume manufacturer, they then have the ability to pull vehicles from across all of the states in the northern section, like the eastern side and the western side. This allows helps with compliance for a lot of the intermediate volume manufacturers have only one or two dealerships in certain states, so it allows them to meet the requirements by putting more vehicles in, say, Maryland, New York, or Massachusetts to help cover Rhode Island or Connecticut. They've also increased from 1 to 3 years the time allowed to make up a ZEV deficit for IBMs, and they're able to use transitional zero-emission vehicles, which are plug-in hybrids, to meet the deficit, whereas large volume manufacturers have to meet the deficit with pure ZEV. The next amendment is to align the CalZEV 3 program with the federal Tier 3 program. know, EPA adopted Tier 3 recently, and it was in coordination with California's program. So this update is merely to better incorporate and align the California program with the EPA program, and it will help manufacturers to certify vehicles to both standards and just make it cheaper and easier for the manufacturers to meet both requirements. They also align the medium heavy-duty greenhouse gas standard in California with EPA's Phase 1 greenhouse gas standard, which was the first nationwide program to regulate greenhouse gases from medium heavy-duty sector. California passed the amendments to align their standards with federal Phase 1, and the update affects sections of California's regulation that were incorporated by reference, but they'll have no regulatory effect on Maryland because we do not have greenhouse gas standards for heavy duty, and the medium duty vehicles we have are only passenger vehicles up to 14,000 pounds. And the final update was to the onboard diagnostic system. California updated the OBD system to provide greater compliance flexibility and strengthen and clarify the performance requirements of the system. The changes will help ensure that the vehicles are meeting the emission standard requirements during the real world usage. Almost all vehicles in the United States are certified to the California OBD system versus the EPA OBD system. So this is, all of these changes are currently in effect in California and in most of the Section 177 states that adopted California program. And that is all of the updates we have to the California program.
Thank you, Joseph. Any questions?
So basically this is, to a certain extent, loosening up some of the regulations to make them more easier to enact and more cost-effective. Is that kind of what's going on here?
Yes, for most of them it is. For the OBD system, it's a straightening actually of that system to make it more stringent, where the tolerance is a little tighter so you can monitor the vehicles, especially as they age. For the others, for the heavy duty and the greenhouse gas and the LEV III, is to kind of coalesce the two requirements together to make it easier for the manufacturers and safer for the LEV program, mainly for the intermediate volume manufacturers.
To clarify, the intermediate volume, kind of like Mazda and Subaru, it was a way to recognize that there's a lot of fiscal investment, right? Some of the new plug-ins and things like that. And it was giving some of these smaller manufacturers a little more time as opposed to, you know, Ford, GM, and Toyota, which are a lot bigger and have a lot more resources. So it was trying to level the playing field a little bit to let these manufacturers compete business-wise, but also make their environmental requirements. The same kind of goes for the kits. There is a big price discrepancy between California and EPA approval process. For EPA to get approved, EPA for the kits, it's about $50,000 per car, but it has been about $180,000. So this process lowered, CARB made some efforts to lower that price down to about $90,000. Still a lot, but it brings it down a little. So it was a little bit more of an effort to make it easier for these kits to go through the CARB approval process, because many of them have chosen not to be approved by CARB and just go for EPA approval, which limits their availability.
Thanks, Tim and Justin. I just have a little bit of a clarification. Did this change come about as a result of the company's initiative with respect to the relaxation for the medium-sized companies to come into compliance?
Well, let's not call it relaxation, but it was
additional time.
The intermediates did meet with all 177 states and CARB to discuss how they could still be competitive requirements, but still, you know, obviously make it easier. So there was a lot of discussions that went on for several months on the best possible solution, where we thought it would still allow them to bring the vehicles, but didn't let them off the hook about introducing. It kind of acknowledged they're not at that volume, so it kind of gave them a couple more years to scale up, but it required the same requirements.
Yeah, the only way for manufacturers to join the optional compliance path and the full vehicles in the region was to place ZEVs in the state. And originally that was in 2016 and 2017 only. So this provided a way of them doing it 2 years before they transition into a large volume manufacturer, which is what some of the manufacturers of Subaru and Mazda are projected to do as their sales grow.
Are these conversion kits before market or after market?
Both aftermarket and
a lot of times Ford is a huge conversion kit from a Ford dealer. So it can be sometimes an OEM, Ford OEM, or sometimes maybe a lot of the company that buys the vehicle and then they kit.
Okay, but you mentioned Ford earlier, Subaru and Mazda. I consider Ford to be pretty big.
So. But no,
for conversion kits.
Oh,
for
you said conversion. Well, okay, so the conversion kits don't apply to Subaru and Mazda?
They do, but I use Ford because most of the conversion kits are used on medium-duty trucks, Ford F-150s, F-250s.
Okay.
They don't really convert light-duty. It's mainly the medium-duty that is doing a lot of conversion, step trucks, and your work truck.
So what are we exactly voting on, or are we voting?
Yeah.
To adopt the changes that are required to stay consistent with the regulations.
Okay, because in our package there, this presentation was in the package, but like a new bylaw, did I miss it?
The very last page of the meeting minutes and agenda does show the changes to the regulation, and as Justin said, it's really in the incorporation by reference. By simply incorporating these reference documents, it gets the changes they're discussing.
The only change is actually to the effective date of the affected section of the incorporation.
Mm-hmm. Sorry. Yeah. That's okay. Yes. Uh huh. And there's.
This is a practice that there have been a number of these IVR reference updates that the CALA program has gone through. This is just the latest iteration of that. So I think we've brought this before the council probably six times since the inception of the CALA program.
And we're still, when we do the notice of proposed action, we make 18 copies available to the public through library systems and through requests through us to if you actually want to see the documents, so they're available to the public if they're special purchase.
So we're just discharging our obligation through the program we've adopted to incorporate by reference health and regulation. The convergence of standards, the automakers having to continue to certify in parallel for some period of time, or do you think the distinction will ever disappear?
I think it's narrowing, but I think, well, because of the zero emission vehicle component of the California CAR program, you're always going to have a little bit of a different process for a certain piece of the California CAR program. But they're clearly coming together, and I was going to say, I don't want to distract the discussion, but one of the really interesting things I've seen over the past 20 years is that it used to be that the automobile manufacturers would, in essence, fight everything tooth and nail, particularly the American automobile manufacturers. And over the past 10 years, that's really changed. And so these guys spent a ton of time working with the manufacturers on all the, California has, how many staff they have doing California cars? They got 60 doing consumer products. They probably have 400 doing cars. So we spend a lot of time on this, and it's been a very good process. Usually when we bring these to you, there's no controversy left to be discussed.
So any further questions?
No, we don't want our taxes.
Department or discussion about this? Is there a motion to adopt the CALAB amendments to call mark 26-1134? Second? Thank you. All in favor of adopting the rule?
I don't know, Sarah on the phone.
Sarah, what's your vote on adopting this rule?
I'm in favor.
Thank you.
Okay. Good.
Thank you all. Appreciate it. Just as an aside, this is really one of the hottest topics we have going in our climate change work. A week from Monday, we have a session of our Climate Commission Mitigation Work Group focused solely on zero emission vehicles, alternative fuel vehicles. And what's interesting is we spent a lot of time on things with smokestacks. And what's happened is that we spent a lot of time on cars too. But we're getting to a point where we need to continue to make progress with vehicle emissions, and it's getting really hard. We've made such, the technology and the fuels have all advanced, and that's why this push for zero or near zero emission vehicles is a big piece of what we're doing. And we have some controversial stuff coming up this year, like our law in Maryland that provides the incentives for excise tax incentives for zero emission vehicles, electric vehicles, through this year. So it'll be an interesting session. There's a lot of push, and a lot of the folks that are pushing it are the manufacturers and small businesses who are investing in infrastructure, like the infrastructure, those kinds of things. So it's very interesting what's going on. So.
Where was the hearing?
What's that?
You said there's a hearing this week.
There is a meeting of our mitigation work group, right, these two?
Oh, it's a work group.
It's a Monday at noon, I don't know what the date is, but it's a week from next month. It's a week from today. And it's focused on, up to this point, our efforts have been focused on energy issues, methane. And this was the one where we're going to branch out and what do we do to continue progress with reducing greenhouse gases from the transportation sector.
Okay, so next we have an informational presentation by Hossein Wahid about emissions guidelines for commercial industrial solid waste consideration.
I think he's still trying to fuck around.
There are two topics we're going to cover, two industry categories considerations, and I just wanted to give you an overview of the topics covered. It's a background and overview on EPA emission guidelines for system integrators. Then we get into a little bit of the examples and exemptions for CCE. And Mellon conducted a review of potential sources and just describe and go over how we did it. And then there's another proposed action that is coming up. It's a negative declaration for CCE. There's the background and overview on the guidelines for SSI that pursue its budget. And the plan has been so far based on recommendations within our programs that is combined with service with the delegation of federal implementation plan. And there is an effective source explaining what they plan to do and the schedule as we had when we finalized this. The CCE emission guidelines were finalized on June 23rd, 2016. And the emission guidelines are in 40 CFR, subpart DDD. These guidelines are broad requirements that EPA places on different types of industries. And as was mentioned earlier, the Advisory Council has reviewed emission guidelines for several industries in the past, close to 12 amendments we have made for different industrial categories, and this is one of the emission guidelines that we'll be incorporating or modifying our regulations. In this instance, we do not need to, but I'll explain that. A CCE unit is an incinerator that is used to burn solid waste that is generated at a commercial operation. It can be an industrial facility, and there is a specific classification that EPA goes by to identify a CISV. Examples of units include, a unit that is incinerating solid waste, energy recovery units that burn solid waste, and waste burning kilns, for example, and also the category that EPA has identified as small remote incinerators. At the same time, in this matrix, there is an exempt category, several categories that EPA exempts, and air curtain incinerators is one of those, pathological waste incineration units, municipal waste combustion units. I think we are familiar with it because there was an update on this, and then there's medical waste incineration. That also is part of Mellon's regulation we already have under COMAR 26 level 08 and there are small power production facilities that also EPA has specific requirements and standards for, so listed here as exempt categories. For cogeneration facilities, there are specific federal standards, and that is why it is exempt from the CISV requirements. And hazardous waste combustion units also have a very detailed program for the control of hazardous waste. The material recovery units are units that utilize the thermal system to recover materials. Therefore, they also exempt. Sewage treatment plants are exempt, and sewage sludge incineration units also. There's another category that EPA covers called the other solid waste incineration units. The way we structured our work is we utilized the North American Industrial Classification System to first identify. Mellon has conducted an active incinerator control program for a long period of time. In fact, Mellon's regulations preceded the emission guidelines for municipal waste combustion and other incinerators. So we analyzed all the 40 incinerators potential candidates, and we reviewed the conditions under which they operate. Only four incinerators did come under a specific category, and those are listed here. We did get in touch with these companies to make sure that they were not falling under the CISV categories. So that part has been completed, and based on this analysis and based on discussions with EPA, in the regional offices and the groups that developed the standards, we'll be submitting a negative declaration to EPA in late 2016. If at a later date another unit comes up and there is a federal plan that is in place to take care of it, it automatically applies and the unit becomes subject to the standards. So the approach to CISVs has been outlined. For sewage sludge incinerators, also EPA issued the federal implementation guidelines on April 14, 2016. These units are enclosed incinerators located near wastewater at the wastewater treatment facility, which combusts domestic sewage sludge for the purpose of reducing volume, and also there is the opportunity to recover energy. Mellon has only one SSI facility, and as I said, we decided that it would be best to seek the delegation to implement the plan so that any concerns a source has can be addressed in Maryland by the department. That is the purpose of this delegation request. And in order to get an approval for the delegation request, Maryland has to demonstrate adequacy of resources, legal authority to administer and enforce the federal SSI plan. You have to provide an emissions inventory of existing affected facilities, a public hearing certification, and a memorandum of agreement that is developed with EPA Region 3 upon receipt of the delegation request. The affected source is Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission, treats about 30.6 million gallons per day of wastewater. The plant has two multiple hearth incinerators, and each is equipped with a flue gas recycle system and the venturi scrubber. The plan is to install a wet electrostatic precipitator to meet the requirements, and also the regenerative thermal oxidizer. So the facility has received the permit to operate the incinerator, and the remaining residual ash is sent to landfill. However, the plans have been modified, so they are looking into bioenergy systems where they can recover the energy through anaerobic process. And that decision has not been made are continuing to work on. This was the schedule if the company planned to utilize the permit to operate and to utilize the incinerator. We are planning on going to the public hearing on December 15th with this request. But it seems that the company has not made the first move to install the necessary equipment, and they probably will need additional time. So that is the part I had on all the incinerators. Commercial as well as SSI. So from EPA's standpoint, they are encouraging energy recovery from such buildings. In the sense, the way the regulation has been structured and all the options that you saw there, the exemptions listed, are all designed to encourage the energy recovery from incineration.
Great job, Hussein. I have a question which reveals my perverse attention to detail. So can you move forward to the place where you have this category, these tables here, the little table, the software? Is this a typo? Why do you have, under examples of potentially regulated entities, manufacturers of machinery, manufacturers of transportation equipment? That has nothing to do with waste and combustion.
Yes, it's a good question. What it does is it identifies the industrial category that a state agency can focus on. For instance, this is a potential category where a CISV could exist or could be utilized. A CISV can be utilized by a car manufacturer, okay. By anyone, any company could utilize it because they're an industrial manufacturer. And as I mentioned, Mellon has done quite an extensive work on incinerators in general. So it was not easy for us to identify where there were gaps. And in order to fulfill any potential gap in our knowledge, we took this approach, utilized our databases, got the information from what small sources may have escaped this regulatory program for several decades. And this is how we went about confirming or reconfirming what we already did.
Thank you.
Yeah, just make a comment that, of course, the purpose of this is to reduce, you know, problems with air quality, right? In regards to comes out of incineration. I would just suggest, and especially in the case of sewage sludge, that on the other side of MDE is the sewage sludge division. And I know from personal research and stuff, there is work that's been done to utilize sludge as for its nutrient value in the growth of trees, which can reduce the inputs, of course, that would have to be incinerated and stuff. And those technologies exist and to this point have not been implemented in the state of Maryland. And I would just suggest that when you look at air quality, that perhaps there's a need to look at work that's been done in Maryland on sewage sludge that's being used in other states, but not Maryland, that would in fact reduce the need to incinerate sewage sludge, and it can be used in a biological recycling system to grow trees, for other purposes. So I'll just mention that from my own personal experience.
Good point. Actually, EPA,
I'd be happy to talk about it in Tom's future.
EPA has looked into this aspect of it, and Maryland too is encouraging wastewater treatment plants through different programs. For instance, just recently they awarded certain energy efficiency projects facilitating energy efficiency at all the wastewater treatment plants through projects and grants, for instance. And each water treatment plant has received some funding assistance from the department to recover energy, for instance. And also for energy efficiency purposes, we have installed solar energy panels on a large scale, and combined heat and power units are also going in. Also, these water treatment plants use extensive pumps and other drive mechanisms. So if you enhance all this through you know, systems that reduce the power requirement you're facilitating. And also the biosolids part is being reviewed, and there is a special group that is looking into the feasibility of allowing and what kind of standards will be applicable, you know, what standards the sewage sludge has to meet. So it's in the works. And there is a NASA technology that also cleans up wastewater to such an extent that it can be applied to a development.
I would just say that there was $800,000 of ratepayer money, dollars spent in Maryland on sewage sludge research done by the University of Maryland on biological systems that has not been implemented at this point.
So not to diminish the importance of this, but my understanding is that this regulation is agnostic about what happens to a waste stream.
Right.
It's simply saying when you do incinerate it, these are the ways to do it.
Yeah, I understand that.
I understood the back trip where the wastewater stream up to last year, they never burned the sludge. The sludge is concentrated in the way and kind of semi-dehydrated to be giving the pellet.
Yeah.
So where does incineration go?
They already had this incinerator. They have had it from the beginning when they installed this wastewater treatment plant. WSSC decided that it was the better option for them. You know, they preferred not to landfill solids. But now they have other options where they can generate energy through this bioenergy aeration process. You know, they think they can match the cost benefits from it, because one project, the enhancement of the incinerator costs $25 million. Whereas the other one also is similar, $25 million cost, but they're looking at what long-term benefits they can derive from it. Like application, for instance, if they can get EPA approval to apply it as a fertilizer, meeting all the standards, then I think it will change the cost equation, economically beneficial towards the side of the anaerobic process, where they can generate energy as well as, you know, utilize the waste stream for other purposes. So now this wastewater, the back river plant, also is generating energy, but in a different way. They have combined heat and power unit that is doing it.
And the improvement they did a few years ago was to use it to capture the methane and funnelize it somewhere rather than burn it, which was burning stuff. But they still have this dehydration type of concentration and dehydration of this fluid.
Yes. So each plant makes its own decision, you know, based on its location and what they can do, whether there's a landfill close by, they take into account the transportation costs and other considerations. So this unit has not been used since 2009. But because it is there and they have a permit, we do have to consider this option where we have to request this delegation. Now, if they make that decision to go one way or keep partial, then we have to act upon it. But Jonathan, the company will be in a work group process with us, you know, providing information. So
I know Blue Plains is going towards digestion, creating pellets, you know, for set of land applications. There's a whole lot of issues involved with biosolids, but there are other options out there that have not been implemented in Maryland.
Hey, from my perspective, it's a beneficial use that keeps things out of the incinerator. One less thing for me to worry about, I said. So
I'll give you something to read then.
Yeah. So. And again, a little background. At the last ACAC meeting, we gave you guys a preview of some of the work we're doing with reasonably available control technology requirements for municipal waste combustors. Hussein's now giving you a little snapshot of the sewage sludge and CISP piece of the process. And Randy, at some point, we're going to be bringing a draft rule to the council, right?
Possibly December 12th, but we'll see. We still have work to do.
I would say, too, that Maryland's one of the few states that still uses the term sewage sludge. Most all states have gone to the term biosolids, interestingly.
Good point. It's EPA terminology.
EPA. Yes. It's EPA.
It's EPA terminology.
Is that what I just, right. Other states have made that great move.
Malorganite's a great product, example.
Water treatment facilities.
I did.
I have to myself.
Okay, we've
Thank you, John.
Done a really good job of sticking to
Thanks
our agenda. We're 1 minute over, but we have one final item to discuss before we adjourn, and that's our next meeting is on December 12th. And the proposed dates for next year, you see at the bottom of the agenda here, March 13th, June 19th, December 18th.
It's a tough time for Christmas.
Any other questions or comments? Randy,
No, no, no. All good. Thank you.
Okay. That will adjourn. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Appreciate everyone coming.
Well, it turns out we actually have about five.